CastleRockRadio.com.
.com.
The future of radio.
Imagine all.
Welcome to Food Integrity Now, news and talk radio advocating integrity in our global food supply. I'm Matt Spaeth, and in the studio with me today are my two co-hosts, Carol Gravet.
Hi, Matt.
And Susan Wright.
Hi, Matt.
So the topic for today's show is food and how can you be self-sustainable? To returning with us on the show today is Matt Stein, the author of When Technology Fails, a manual for self-reliance, sustainability, and surviving the long emergency. We had Matt on the show a couple weeks ago, and it was just an amazing show. His book is really, should be called the Bible of skills that you need in life but didn't learn in school. Basically, it covers everything you need to know to live as a person. And we got into emergency preparedness that time, the importance of a take-and-go kit. And I think the people in the Northeast, probably some, a lot of them are wishing that they had an emergency kit during that huge snowstorm.
Yeah, you're right.
Over Christmas. And so we barely even touched on the wealth of information that Matt offers in his book, When Technology Fails. And one of the things that people are really interested in today are is growing their own food. And because we talk about how the quality of our food and our food supply is declining and how we're giving our power away to corporations and people to monitor the integrity of our food. A lot of us just want to take that back for ourselves and are interested in how we can grow food efficiently using what we have. People live in cities, people live suburbs, who might not have a lot of land to really have a farm, but there's some interesting techniques that have been becoming more and more popular, such as permaculture and other methods that really do great to increase the yield. And I think we have Matt on the line. Matt, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Matt.
Thanks a lot for having me back on.
Awesome. So I hope you had a good holiday. And
yeah, it was excellent. Got to spend some time with our daughter and her husband down in San Francisco. So most people came up to the snow for Christmas, and we went down from the snow to where it's evergreen.
Sounds great. We've been
But right now, I got a winter wonderland. I'm out my window. We get about 3 feet or 3 or 4 feet of snow outside, and everything's all the trees are encrusted in white. It's very pretty.
I love that. It's like almost 60 degrees here in Colorado today.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's going to change, though. It's supposed to be one degrees in 2 days. So.
Yeah, right.
Right.
We're bracing for that, enjoying it while we can.
Yeah, we got some cold weather supposed to be coming in tonight. Yeah, been snowing. They get through probably 4 or 5 feet, about 15 feet in the last week and a half up higher.
Wow!
And good heavy snow, good Sierra cement.
Great. So the buzzword these days seems to be permaculture. It's really increasingly coming into people's consciousness, and I see more and more people offering permaculture courses and people wanting to take permaculture courses. But, you know, this is the second chapter or the second topic in your book. I think you have a good section on this. A lot of people don't know what this is. And I think it's a fascinating topic. Can you give us a quick overview of what permaculture is?
Right. I'll put a caveat on it. I'm not a teacher and an expert on permaculture, but I've got some really good information and lots of great references in my food chapter in the book. And permaculture is basically a way of sort of mimicking nature to some extent with a little bit of human intervention to try, you know, see, in nature, everything is recycled. Everything is sustainable. What dies one day becomes food for something else. And so in nature, there's nothing thrown away. It's cradle to cradle, you know, that everything starts something else. So the principles of permaculture are looking at how nature makes a permanently sustaining system and tries to mimic that within your property in terms of reusing all of the waste, of recycling everything, of nurturing natural plants and sort of more of a natural way of doing it so that it doesn't require a lot of once you get it started and kind of get everything rolling, it doesn't require a lot of intervention on the human being's part. And it's more like getting the system balanced and natural. So it's a way of growing lots of food. You can have sort of edible gardens, edible forests. There's some really wonderful books by my publisher, Chelsea Green, on permaculture that sort of become like the Bible. They're kind of expensive and they're huge. And there's naturally Bill Mollison's first permaculture book, which is like the Bible of permaculture. But this guy's taken it sort of a step further for North American and Northern European gardens, whereas Bill Mollison was down in Australia. So it's a way, wonderful way of transforming your property into a more natural system that produces abundant food and controls pests very well and you know requires sort of minimal inputs from the human beings once it's gotten itself going right.
That's great. I think a lot of people would love that. We tend to think of gardening as requiring so much work, but if we can get the system to work for itself, that's pretty remarkable.
Now, there's another thing that I talk about, and John Jevons, who invented grow biointensive gardening practices, he gave me permission to include the diagrams and the details on growing biointensive within my food chapter. And that's, you know, basically you can use that along with in permaculture, there's nothing sort of conflicting between grow biointensive and permaculture. But grow biointensive is a very specific gardening practice with double digging where your soil gets richer and deeper and better every year without chemical inputs or with just some maybe perhaps some minimal inputs in the beginning of soil testing and deciding what your soil needs. And it's a way of recycling and composting in a smart way so that it's taking the natural stuff that you're growing on your property and doing it in such a way that your ground becomes more fertile and better. So, for instance, in Africa, they have some incredible pictures of these guys who were barely eking out an existence on their property, like you know, barely feeding themselves, basically starvation kind of on their limited land. And when they taught them grow biointensive, the skills and the techniques for grow biointensive, they turned this sort of like barely subsistence farming into the exact same amount of land and actually using less water and less and no chemical inputs. They end up turning this into like an incredibly bountiful farm where it's producing several times the amount of what it used to produce. And grow biointensive was developed sort of by a combination of things, by some real master gardeners really looking at how nature did it and sort of boosting it and doing it in better ways. So it's very synergistic with the principles of permaculture. There's like really nothing, you know, bad about grow biointensive or permaculture. They're just sort of two different ways that can easily be combined together to allow you to super produce in a very small part of land.
Wow. So I see the grow biointensive uses the principle of hexagonal space planting. So it, in essence, uses sacred geometry in the way you lay out your garden.
Yeah, see, modern factory farming methods were made up not necessarily what was really good for the soil, or definitely not what was good for the soil and good for the plants. They were made in terms of what was good for mechanized machinery-type farming. And grow biointensive is more looking at natural systems and how nature brings plants in next to each other to shelter themselves. And so you can have what's companion planting and natural spacing of planting. So rather than being optimized for the farm machinery, it's optimized for the plants so that the plants are healthiest and grow best and have the least amount of additives in the soil and use the least amount of water. So you can get a huge, you can get kind of the most amount out of a small space and actually have your soil get deeper and richer and better every year after year after year instead of depleted. So in the Western way of growing things, basically the soil's dead from all the chemicals. And if you don't keep adding chemicals and chemical fertilizer every year, you get your crops are gone. There's like nothing there. Whereas in grow biointensive, the soil is healthy and natural and growing thicker and deeper and richer every year after year. So it's and similarly with permaculture. Like I said, grow biointensive and permaculture, they can be synergistic techniques that blend together.
Got it.
Well, that makes so much sense, you know, to have the plants work together to get the maximum yield of the space you're using. I mean, it just makes common sense, you know, to do it that way.
Yeah, unless you have a lot of land. Now, there's another book out there that, you see, each of my chapters in my book ends in a resource guide. And so, like, there's a whole number of different books on permaculture and natural farming. And there's another one, which is slightly different take on things. It's called Gardening Where It Counts or something like that. I'd have to look it up. I don't have it memorized. But that guy sort of looked at, well, say you have lots of land and it's not great producing land and you want to produce as, you know, the amount of land isn't the problem. You want to sort of produce a lot of vegetables with the least amount of efforts. And so his book is kind of good for that situation, whereas grow biointensive is great for, like, how do I produce a lot in a small area? And permaculture is like, how do I look at the whole thing, my water, my sewage, my how I generate my power and generate electricity and maybe biogas, how do I make my system as self-sustaining as possible, sort of looking at the whole bigger picture, whereas grow biointensive is just looking at the gardening end of it. Mm-hmm. Permaculture is really looking at the whole picture, the whole system.
That's fascinating, Matt. We're going to take this break and go to a message from our sponsors. This is Food Integrity Now. We'll be right back with more Matt Stein.
Masterson, Soul Purpose Astrologer, works with astrological tools and with guides in the non-physical to assist ones in knowing their soul purpose. Important in this process is identification of significant blockages. In each session, tools are provided for working with self to clear resistance and free talents, skills, and abilities to fuller expression. The goal is to take responsibility for and to accelerate the healing process. Phone sessions are offered by Linda. Please visit Linda at lindamasterson.com or call 808-651-0307. Again, that's 808-651-0307. I'm Carol Gervais, and I'm a certified life coach and one of the hosts of the Food Integrity Now show right here on Castle Rock Radio. Have you ever dreamed of swimming with the wild and free dolphins? I'm not talking about the ones in captivity like the ones at Dolphin Quest. I'm talking about swimming with them in the wild. If this is something you've only dreamt about doing, I invite you to mark this off your bucket list now and join me for an all-inclusive trip to swim with the wild dolphins. Your trip to paradise will include organic gourmet meals, ocean waterfront accommodations, Lomi Lomi massage, and much more. What are you waiting for? Now is the time to make your dream a reality. For more information, go to wilddolphinswimadventures.com or contact me at carol@coachwithcarol.com or 719-687-7447. Once again, that's 719-687-7447. Mahalo.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. We've been talking with Matt Stein, author of When Technology Fails, and we've been talking about permaculture, which is a type of sustainable farming and gardening that uses nature as a model. And one of the first things that I read about permaculture was there was a rancher that used those principles to raise his cattle, and he had built a circular pasture that had sections like a pie, and he would just open one section and they would just kind of wander over to the next section of pasture when he wanted them to move. And so his cows were basically happy cows, and they had a lot of plants and things that were healing. He'd seeded the pasture with a lot of medicinal plants. What other ways, Matt, do you know about that animals contribute to that system in permaculture?
Well, for instance, traditionally in the Native American past, we had buffalo that traveled around in herds through the Great Plains. And what they would do is they would intensively graze and sort of dig up with their hoofs a section of the prairie. And then they would move over to another section and another section, another section. So some of the, if you're using farm animals in permaculture, you can have movable paddocks so that you're sort of mimicking nature in terms of grazing in one spot and moving on. And so they're both grazing and they're digging it up with their hooves, and they're fertilizing with their feces one area and then moving to another. So a lot of permaculture is looking at the natural systems of nature and saying, okay, let's replicate and duplicate these systems as much as possible in a way that benefits us and allows us to live sustainably. And so there you're duplicating. And so similarly, you can have chickens, and chickens are great for like eating all the nasty bugs and fertilizing the soil and all of that. And so you can have your movable sort of coop so that you have a little area where the chickens are one day and they go there for a few days, and then you move it over to another spot and another spot and another spot. And in that way, you're duplicating nature and you're making a much healthier system.
Yeah, in fact, earlier you were talking about the space issue, and I had just read an article that one of our friends, Amanda Harrison, had posted on Facebook about a man who was using plants to filter water, and he was growing fish in the city. So the fish are completely clean and free of any, you know, the heavy metals that they can accrue out in the ocean, and it was being completely just filtered out by these plants, and it was basically a little water ecosystem that he'd created. Thought that was really interesting.
They call them living machines. You can make living machines to process sewage and waste and return them. See, in nature, there's nothing thrown away. Everything is like reprocessed and reused. And human beings have gone away from that, where we have dumps and toxic waste and all of that we throw away. Well, nature doesn't do that. So in the living systems that people make to reprocess human waste, then it's going back into the soil, and it's using plants and natural microorganisms to recirculate that human waste and make for a better water quality and better soil, both, and food. Good food. You get good food out of it.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to have one of those going to my house. Matt, what's it like at your house? What kind of things you have going on in terms of growing your own food?
I used to have a lot, and right now I end up having to move back from Hawaii, and I don't have that much now. I used to have 10 acres in Nevada City, and we had an acre of garden, all organic, and chickens, and boy, those, you know, you take the stuff from the juicer and you feed it to the chickens and you get great eggs. I took some severe financial losses and moved for a job, and so right now I'm in the process of working to get back to that, and hopefully before the world falls apart, I do get back to that, because that's certainly my goal. I mean, like I live in a place right now that frosts 11 months out of the year, and gardens are a struggle here unless you've got a really great greenhouse. So my son's got 20 acres in Oregon, and so it's a possibility of building a cabin and working there. So we're working and getting back to where we were a number of years ago, and hopefully we'll do that while there's still time left to get everything going.
Go ahead. I said, no. With that in mind of you not growing your own food right now, what do you recommend for our listeners as far as what foods are good to have that are storable and, you know, when technology fails, what's good to have?
Well, storable, it's a variety of things. I mean, most stored food systems focus on wheat and whole grain wheat, like natural wheat berries. Because if it's properly stored, you know, you can use some CO2 in 5-gallon buckets, kind of like big paint buckets, but obviously you buy them new and don't use old paint buckets. And the wheat can last basically forever. It'll last far longer than you or I will live if it's properly stored. But you really have to think about what you and your family eat. So in my wife's case, she's kind of sensitive to wheat, so we're more prone towards rice and beans. And there you have to make sure, especially with brown rice, you have to make sure that you rotate it, because the oils and the germ in the brown rice, the germ meaning the natural husk and the natural oils in the brown rice, will go rancid and turn bad in, you know, 1 to 3 year kind of period. So if you're counting on brown rice, then you've got to rotate that through fairly often. And so good things to store is a variety, something you're going to eat. Wheat, brown rice, a variety of whole beans. Think about sprouting, because sprouting is something anybody can do, and you don't need a bunch of land to sprout. And when you sprout grain, it loses a slight amount of calories, but it transforms a lot of the simple carbohydrates into vitamins and minerals that you can use. So, for instance, there's an anecdote in my book about a guy who had read about how great sprouts were for chickens. So he took the same amount of feed for his chickens, and he sprouted it and then fed it to the chickens, and found that the chickens became like 50% heavier and healthier on the same amount of food in the same amount of time simply by sprouting it before he fed it to the chickens. And so personally, I like to eat sprouted grain bread, and I've also have a grain grinder, so I can sprout my own grain and make my own sort of, you know, Bible bread, Ezekiel bread, whatever you want to call it, out of sprouted grain.
I love that stuff. Yeah, I was going to, I was just thinking about the people in New York in the couple of days after Christmas when they all got snowed in. Everyone was complaining that they couldn't get delivery because no one was on the roads. And I was thinking, I used to live in New York, and I never used to store more than half a day's worth of food in my fridge, just because it was...
That doesn't last very long, no. I think in this day and age, I mean, you got to use your judgment, because what's right one day may not be right the next. So I don't have a year's worth of food on hand. My wife keeps saying, come on, we got to do that. I've certainly got over a month's worth of food on hand. My goal is within the next 6 months to store up a year and be rotating it through. But you need space for that, and you need some bucks for that. But I do have at least a month on hand of a large pantry and some sacks of grain and beans. And I've got a generator so that when the power goes out, naturally the generator is only going to work so long as you got gas. So it's not a long-term solution, but if the power's out for 4 or 5 days or a week, which can happen with storms in our area, and certainly could happen due to a natural calamity or a man-made act, or just the grid melting down because of some old system like happened in Niagara Falls a few years back. So, you know, with at least a generator and things, I've got a special mail-to-mail plug. I've got to advise you against it, because if you don't know what you're doing, you can electrocute yourself. But you disconnect your breaker to shut you off from the grid, and you plug it into my wall, and I can keep my refrigerators and, you know, computer, and if you've got a fan on a furnace, you can run that with a little generator, at least off and on. And if you run it continuously, you go through a ton of gas. But, you know, you run it every few hours, you crank it up for a half hour, an hour, and you keep your food from rotting and keep everything going. And it's good for a short-term solution, not for the end of the world.
What do you use for, so you have natural gas at the place that you're at right now?
Right, we have natural gas, and we've heated with wood for years, and we also have, I also have a trailer with a solar panel and solar power. So that's like my, if you can't afford the $25,000 system for your whole house, you can certainly have a small backup system that can provide you with enough power to run some lights and, you know, maybe a small computer, things like that. Right. I can do that off of it. I can't certainly run my whole household on it.
I got a portable solar panel array the other day. It folds up to about 8.5 by 11. You can run a laptop off it. It's really amazing.
And folds up to an 8.5 by 11. Wow.
Yeah, and it's kind of flexible too.
Well, that's cool. That'll be good unless there's nobody to communicate with.
Yeah,
if everybody else's computers are down.
You know, one of the beauties of my book is that it covers everything from, like, how do you plan for and deal with the minor bumps in the road? You know, you have a big storm, the power's out for a few days. How do you keep your pipes from freezing? You know, how do you keep your food from rotting? What kind of things should you have if you have to? Like, I live in earthquake and wildfire country, so it's quite conceivable that, you know, an earthquake could come along, knock some bridges down, so my car wouldn't get me more than a mile or two down the road. And it might be a wildfire coming down. I might have to put things on my pack and hoof it. So it allows you to prepare for all of those. And then it also gives you sort of the low-tech 18th century technology tools so that if things really fell apart really bad, you wouldn't be, and you were a bit handy, and even if you didn't know how to figure out everything I'm talking about in the book, somebody, one of your neighbors probably could do it. So you could get by on more like 18th century technology rather than the Stone Age, you know, than falling back to Mad Max and the Stone Age. So it's, you know, I mean, I'm hoping that never happens in my lifetime.
Us too.
But like many other people.
I got to cut you off right here, Matt. I'm sorry. But we got to take this break. You're listening to Food Integrity Now with Matt Stein. We'll be right back.
Looking for some flavorful, healthy, fresh food? Come out to Maximilian's Cafe in Woodland Park, Colorado, focusing on local, fresh ingredients with a changing seasonal menu. Located at 209 East Midland Avenue, Woodland Park, Colorado, right off Highway 24 in downtown. Our walls are full of local artist artwork, and on Friday and Saturday nights, we feature local singers, songwriters, and performers to entertain you while you relax and enjoy a fun environment, a glass of wine, and fantastic food. Open 7 days a week from 11 to 9 p.m., 11 to 8 p.m. on Sunday and Monday.
Are you seeking understanding and assistance in healing your depression and anger or lack of passion? Hi, my name is Tammy Urbanek at Empowerment Through Healing. I'm a medium clairvoyant who can work with your spirit guides to assist you. Your spirit guides can offer solutions and understanding at current life issues that you're facing. Visit www.empowermentthroughhealing.com for more information, and you can call me at 719-641-2017.
Experiencing anxiety, anger, depression, or low self-esteem? Do you beat yourself up or sabotage what you truly want to achieve? Hi, this is Jeannie Smith, and at Open Heart Healing, I combine counseling, Gestalt therapy, and Tai Chi energy work to assist those who truly desire to bring quality and joy back into their lives. My office is located on South Perry Street here in Castle Rock. Call me for a free consultation at 303-660-6373. Again, that's 303-660-6373, or visit me at openhearthealing.com.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. Our guest, Matt Stein. Before the break, Matt was talking about some of the 18th century techniques that he features in his book, talking, and just in case, you know, just some good stuff to know, just in case the time ever comes that you need it. I'm interested in these things just because I find them fascinating. I'm personally carving my own bow from a bow stave right now. My friends are teaching me how to do that. I'm curious, Matt, have you actually used any of these techniques in here?
Yeah, I've used some of the stuff, sand filter, and certainly, yeah, I've done double digging, and we've done the organic gardening and raised the chickens, and I'm not great at slaughtering chickens myself. I used to duck hunt and, you know, gut birds and barbecue them and all of that good stuff. I've spent tons of time in the backcountry. I've done a lot of the, pretty much everything in the alternative healing chapter, all the different herbs and techniques and healing stuff. You know, built snow caves and slept out in the snow. As far as building a fire with a bow and drill, I haven't done that yet. And I must admit, even a flint and steel is a real bear to use, so it's great to practice on. But some people say they poo-poo when I, you know, talk about the waterproof matches, the butane lighters and stuff. And those are really handy modern gadgets. If you've ever tried to build a fire with a flint and steel, it's a really good skill to know. But if your tinder is not 100% dry and just perfect and there's no wind and all of that, chances are you're not going to get it lit.
Yeah.
So it's like it's really great to know these backup things, but to count on them when you could have a butane lighter or something. I mean, obviously, if everything falls apart and you don't have any of those other things, then you're going to have to use some of those 18th century skills or medieval skills that I've got, like flint napping you know, all of the snares and stuff for animals in the book. But let me give you a little story to give you an idea of how valuable and how tough some of these things are. There's a guy who teaches survival classes in Arizona told me this story. And he said that in his, you know, after like a week-long class, they split the class up into small groups of people for sort of not a solo. They go out like two or three people together or small groups together. And he says, to fend for themselves with only primitive tools. Like, you can't bring a knife along, no matches, no nothing. It's just, you know, you gotta forage for it, and you have to make your tools out there. And he says typically they split, the women tend to group together and the men group together, and they go out for 3 days. And by day three, the starving men generally hungrily look over the shoulders of the women. And see, the women have been focusing on foraging for edible roots and tubers and berries and plants and things like that. And the men have been focusing on hunting and fishing, because it's kind of like the guy thing is go out and hunt and fish. Well, it turns out that when you have primitive tools, the hunting and fishing is damn hard. And so the guys are all starving, and the women have gone out and foraged for the natural bounty of nature and edible fruits and tubers and nuts and berries and things, and they're doing just fine. So in the long run, like, if you really want to add your survival kit, I mean, having the gun and the fishing gear and all of that is definitely worthwhile, but having that edible herb and plant book might really be what makes the difference. And certainly in the Donner Party era, if they'd known they could have, in my town where they had their infamous barbecue 150 years ago when they ran out of food and resorted to cannibalism. If they'd known, they could have stripped the trees down to the green layer of bark, just like the deer do when they're starving, and taken that green layer and stewed it up or pounded it into sort of a grain, you know, like a flour for bread and pancakes, then they would have been a lot better off. But they didn't know those sorts of things. They were counting on hunting, and in the deep snows and middle of winter, they weren't able to go out and hunt for much of anything.
That's great to know. I certainly need to get that book for myself. I've been starting to get more into paying attention to what's in my backyard and eating what's available.
Yeah, I like to, when I go running, there's spring over here with some watercress growing in it. It's great. And there's a few other herbs, and it's definitely an area where I've got lots of books, and I want to expand my knowledge. But I do like eating the, you know, the natural fiddleheads and the natural watercress and lamb's tongues, you know, different, so a few plants that I know of out there, and it could make a huge difference. Now, in terms of the world, I'm not a paranoid survivalist, but on the other hand, there are six trends that I've kind of simplified things and said we've got six major trends in the planet that are, I call them the sort of the perfect storm. There are six trends, each of which could be a civilization buster. And so far, none of the six trends have we succeeded in even slowing them down, much less reversing them. And so basically, as a scientist and engineer, if you've got a graph and it's steeply dropping, then eventually it's going to hit the bottom. And when it hits the bottom, things fall apart. And right now in our world, we're doing what's called overshoot, which means that we're consuming and destroying the natural systems of the planet faster than they're able to recover. So if we keep doing what we're doing, it's 100% sure we're going to collapse the planet as we know it. We'll continue the mass extinction that we started, and a lot of us won't be around. So I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't say when exactly this is going to like coalesce and be really catastrophic for humankind. But I will say, unless we start really changing things, that things don't look very good. When I ask questions in a group of people and I say, well, how many people think that no matter what we do, the world's going to fall apart, and a few hands come up. And then how many people think that we're going to change this and stop collapsing, and a few hands come up. And basically, most of the hands of the people come up when you ask the question of, like, how many people think that if we get slapped around badly enough and see some really big calamities, that humankind might actually do the massive changes needed to prevent collapse. And that's when about the majority of people's hands come up. So essentially, I'm not alone in feeling slightly optimistic that we actually stand a chance at avoiding collapse. And I'm also not alone in feeling that we probably need to be slapped around a lot worse than we've already been slapped around before we make the major changes to avoid collapse. And then a lot of us wonder, like, if things are going down too fast at that point in time, if we wait too long before we wake up and kind of realize what's happening, will it be too late? Will we have passed the tipping point, and will it go over the edge no matter what we do at that point in time? And that's a question I can't answer. I wish I could, but I can't. I'd be lying. I'd be just giving you my best guess. Yeah. I don't claim to have the answer.
Those are some great questions to ponder. I think a lot of people have those on their mind. I want you to talk about your HuffPost article on bat casting. But before we get to that, Carol had a question about cooking.
Yeah, this is just kind of a simple question, Matt. What do you think is going to be the best way for you to cook your food? Let's say you're without any power for 30, 60 days. What's your plan?
Well, 30, 60 days, it's wood. I mean, wood or solar. I mean, solar ovens are terrific, and they save a tremendous amount of fuel, and they're starting to build them in the third world, and you can build them with, you know, tin foil and cardboard box. And my sister has lived off-grid for like 20 years now, and she cooks all summer long in a solar oven. She's up in eastern Oregon where it's very sunny and deserty, but in the winter it can be stormy. So in stormy weather, certainly solar oven doesn't do you any good. It only works when you get bright, clear, sunny days. And so it's pretty much wood or that. Now, if you've got a system where you've set up to where you're growing chickens and you can do biogas and you can generate your own biogas and cook that way, then that's like having natural gas and an endless supply of natural gas, so long as your chickens are still around, or your geese, or your cows, or whatever you're using, or your human manure, you know, whatever you're supplying it with. So a natural gas digester and biogas is certainly an option for cooking fuel.
There's
a new tool called biochar. Mm-hmm. That is, I'm familiar with it. It's not in my book. I haven't looked into it deeply enough because I've just been too snowed. But you can make a biochar. It's actually a carbon negative way of cooking your food, and it's a way of stabilizing carbon into the planet. and getting it out of the atmosphere. And it uses, I believe it's using wood or like, you know, corn stalks, things like that. And it gases, it burns with like an invisible flame that is totally smokeless and totally pollutionless flame. And you actually stabilize more carbon than it consumes. It's kind of sounds too good to be true, but as I understand it, it isn't. That it really is true, and it's called biochar, and it's a special sort of small stove that you can use to cook on that actually stabilizes carbon. And you put the biochar back into the soil and into the earth, and it's actually stabilizing carbon. So it's an interesting concept, but I don't claim to be an expert on it. I haven't built one of the stoves yet, and I haven't used one. I've just heard some lectures and picked up a couple of books on it, but haven't had the time to really devote to it. But that's another alternative. It's sort of using wood, but using it in a carbon negative way.
Do you have instructions in your book on how to build a solar oven?
I don't have the instructions, but I have a contact for an excellent set of instructions in my book for how to build the solar oven.
Okay.
So far I don't have the actual instructions, but I tell you where to go to get like a set of really good, fine instructions for building a solar oven.
Great. Well, we're about to go to a break, and before we go to a break, would you just let our listeners know about your website and the name of your book and where to get it?
Sure. The website is www.whentechfails, whentechfails.com. Tons of great information. If you click on the article section, you'll see stuff on the grab and run kit, first aid, purifying water, how to protect yourself from the next superbug. Lots of great, totally free information. And you can buy the book on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. But if you can, try to support your local bookstore. And so you can go in there, and many of them stock it. If they don't, you can ask them to order it, and they'll have it for you in two or three days. They should have a copy of the book if they don't have it in stock.
Okay, great. Well, we are going to take a break. You are listening to Food Integrity Now. Please pay attention to our sponsors, and we will be right back. Masterson, Soul Purpose Astrologer, works with astrological tools and with guides in the non-physical to assist ones in knowing their soul purpose. Important in this process is identification of significant blockages. In each session, tools are provided for working with self to clear resistance and free talents, skills, and abilities to fuller expression. The goal is to take responsibility for and to accelerate the healing process. Phone sessions are offered by Linda. Please visit Linda at lindamasterson.com or call 808-651-0307. Again, that's 808-651-0307. I'm Carol Gervais, and I'm a certified life coach and one of the hosts of the Food Integrity Now show right here on Castle Rock Radio. Have you ever dreamed of swimming with the wild and free dolphins? I'm not talking about the ones in captivity like the ones at Dolphin Quest. I'm talking about swimming with them in the wild. If this is something you've only dreamt about doing, I invite you to mark this off your bucket list now and join me for an all-inclusive trip to swim with the wild dolphins. Your trip to paradise will include organic gourmet meals, ocean waterfront accommodations, Lomi Lomi massage, and much more. What are you waiting for? Now is the time to make your dream a reality. For more information, go to wilddolphinswimadventures.com or contact me at carol@coachwithcarol.com or 719-687-7447. Once again, that's 719-687-7447. Mahalo.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. Our guest today, Matt Stein. We just had a great three segments on all sorts of great information techniques that you can find in Matt's book, When Technology Fails. And I wanted to talk about a Huffington Post article that Matt wrote recently. I think it came out on the 27th on backcasting. And I found it to be a fascinating article and an interesting way to look at the process of creating a goal in a way that I hadn't really considered before, in the way it's presented. And do you want to talk about that, Matt?
Sure. See, a lot of people, part of the problem with creating a new future is that, like Einstein said, you can't solve the problems with thinking and creativity at the same level that caused the problems to begin with. It's like you've got to go to a new level to solve them. And part of the problem of traditional brainstorming is you tend to project the past forward. You tend to see the future in terms of your current tools and your current ways of looking at things. So there's a very powerful tool called backcasting. And the title of the article on HuffPost is Backcasting into the Future. So with backcasting, what you do, and this is a tool that everybody can use, and hopefully as thousands and hundreds of thousands of people start doing it, we'll start seeing our way into a sustainable future instead of continuing the trends, the six trends that are leading towards collapse right now. So with backcasting, what you do is you go to the future that you want first in your mind's eye. You say, like, okay, let me picture a future where we have a sustainable world, where our oceans are regenerating and not being overfished and overharvested and overpolluted, and where our rainforests are actually regenerating instead of being cut down, and where our population is decreasing instead of increasing. And so you sort of picture this kind of utopian planet, like, yeah, this is the future. I mean, this is what we want, because if we don't change these trends, then all of the trends that are heading downwards are going to keep going until we hit the wall. So then you start stepping backwards, and you say, okay, let me step back one little step from this wonderful utopian global renaissance that I'm imagining in my mind and say, like, okay, where's the next step back? How did I get here? You step back and you step back and you step back. So by going backwards, you start seeing, like, one is in your future vision, you see all of the wonderful systems that are sustainable that are implemented on the planet. And then as you go backwards, you start seeing, how did we make changes in our systems to get these things implemented? So for instance, when I step backwards, I look and it's like, oh, we changed the way we financed our elections. We changed our election financing. We got rid of, we eliminated corporate financing and went to public financing, because right now we have a world where the Republicans and the Democrats and the Supreme Court are all owned by the corporations. Basically, corporate money has put them in there, and in fact, they've been changing the rules, so now corporations are allowed to donate as much money as they want to individuals under, quote, free speech. I mean, it's like a huge travesty, but it happened. And so it's like, unless people, you start stepping backwards and say, oh, naturally we change this, because if we don't change this, then corporate self-interest will keep the systems going the way they are right now, which means hitting the wall and collapsing. And so with backcasting, you get it's a wonderful way of getting around the limitations of our current way of thinking by leapfrogging past it into the future and then stepping back step by step by step back to where we are now and seeing how we actually implemented these changes, how we transformed our planet in the right direction instead of continuing the current trends in the wrong direction.
So I have a question. When you're doing this stepping back, do you go all the way back to the present, to where you are now, and then take those steps, or do you... Can you explain that? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, this is taught in by the natural step is a system for sustainability and a philosophy of sustainability that was developed in Sweden by a scientist who had been researching and looking at, he was doing cancer research, and he noticed that the cells of the body, when they got into it, when the environment was no longer good enough to nurture the growth of the cells, then they died. And he realized, oh my God, you know, we're doing this to our environment on the planet, and at some point we'll reach it where it no longer can nurture the human beings on the planet, and we will die. We will have soiled the nest and destroyed the environment to the point where most or all of us will die. So he started defining the criteria of sustainability and what it means to be sustainable, and then they started thinking, well, now how we've got this criteria, but how do we implement it? How do we make it happen? And then they started developing the tool of backcasting. And I believe it was developed for coaching before that, but they applied it to sort of allowing us to problem solve how we can make it from where we are now to where we want to be.
So it's like focusing on what you want and then stepping back and seeing what steps you need to get there.
Right. And by stepping back from the point in the future and allowing your imagination, your mind's eye, your spiritual guidance, whatever you want to call it, to go wild, you can sort of free yourself from the limitations of our current way of thinking. And by stepping backwards, then it's like you've gotten around the limitations of the current way of thinking, projecting our past forward. You're projecting the future backwards, and you're doing it one step at a time and kind of observing exactly what changes along the way we're made to get to that place where we all want to be.
Yeah, I learned that technique. I kind of forgot about it until you brought it up. I am a life coach, and we learned a technique where you project your future self and the person
right.
Person you want to be, and then you go back to, okay, how do I get to that self that I want to be? So it's the same thing, but to use this with creating sustainability and changing the world. That's pretty exciting.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Thanks for bringing that to our awareness.
It is very exciting. And you know, some of the things, when you do the exercise, it kind of surprises you because it's like some stuff that you think, like, no, that's impossible right now. And when you backcast it, it's like, no, not only is it impossible, it's imperative. It's like, we must do this or we won't make it. We won't get to that. And we'll get to the Mad Max future instead of the global renaissance future. And, you know, I don't know anyone who wants, I mean, maybe there's some macho guys want to do Omega Man and Mad Max, but I think most of us would rather slide into a nice global renaissance where there's plenty for everybody and the planet is regenerating and healing and we've gotten off fossil fuels and we've made these massive transformations. It's just the momentum is carrying us in the opposite direction right now, and so that's what's hard is getting the people in the world to rise up. Now, an interesting thing is there's a book called Blessed Unrest by Paul Hawken, and he started researching, I think at the time he found 500,000, but now there's something like 2 million independent organizations in the world devoted to sustainability, to global change, to environmental and social change. So what that is an indicator of is that humanity is getting it on a massive scale, that what we're doing isn't working, and if we continue, we're going to crash the system. But we aren't getting it enough to change the powers that be and the momentum of the corporate structure that's taking us in towards this apocalyptic ending. And so that's where people waking up and backcasting on large numbers and starting to say, hey, you know, I'm seeing a future and I'm seeing a path towards a future I want. And so now how do we wake up humanity and make it happen? You know, it's the big challenge. It's like there's wonderful, exciting challenges in our world. And you know, nobody likes a boring movie where you know exactly what's going to happen and nothing really exciting happens. It's like we've signed up for the exciting movie on this time on planet Earth, and do we end up with Mad Max or do we end up with global renaissance? You know, what are we going to collectively make on this planet, and are we going to wake up and shift before it's too late?
I can see that as your next book, Matt. Stein's Manifesto of the full flowchart from where we are to the utopian society.
And I have a challenge for our listeners out there. Let's all focus on the global renaissance and, you know, vision that and take your own personal steps to get there. You know, it starts with a small group and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
That's right. You know, President Lincoln didn't single-handedly eliminate slavery. I mean, millions and millions of people woke up in this country and around the world and said slavery is an evil. It must be defeated and must be eliminated. And finally, they got someone in government to make it happen. And the government followed the people. The government did not lead the people, and rarely does an enlightened government lead the people. Generally, the government is pulled kicking and screaming in a new direction. And certainly it happened with the American Revolution. You know, it wasn't easy. Those guys all had their necks on the lines. If they lost, they would all be hung as for treason or shot or whatever, killed. So it was like, but they had that vision, and it was a massive vision, and they made that step. And the question now is, are we going to wake up to that new vision, and are we going to transform it? Or are we going to let the old way of doing things just keep its momentum going forward, keep all the systems going downward till they start collapsing one at a time, or maybe all at the same time? It's like, I'm not quite sure what the order is in the scheme of things.
Well, Matt, this has been a fabulous show. Thank you for coming on again.
No, you're welcome.
Yeah, once again, will you quick give us your websites again? You have whentechnologyfails.com.
The website is www.whentechfails.com, and like I said, lots of great information there. And I like to leave people with my motto, too. And my motto is, I urge everyone to do your best to change the world and to do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. And, you know, it's like, on the one hand, I want to see us transform the planet into sustainability. And on the other hand, the practical part of me says, you know, even if we do everything right, there's going to be some major bumps in the road. So I'm trying to give people the tools to prepare and weather the storms as those bumps happen. And hopefully we'll avoid the full collapse, or hopefully it'll happen slow enough that, you know, we'll have time to really swing things around. I don't know. Your guess is maybe as good as mine.
Thank you so much for all your great information.
I love that motto. Thanks for listening. Next week, we will be doing a rerun, our show with Jeffrey Smith on GMOs.
Yeah, he was a fabulous guest, so tune in for that show, because he's just enlightened us a lot about what's happening around the world and all the work that the non-GMO project is doing.
So much good stuff.
Yeah, he's got a great book. I'd like to listen to your show. That sounds
great.
Yeah. Jeffrey Smith's a wonderful guy.
Yep. We love him. Well, we love you too. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks again. Have a great day.
You too. And to our listeners, we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Thanks.